This is Scenic Roots. I'm Ray Bassett. Thanks for joining us. As the Chattanooga area sees more new cases of COVID-19, and Hamilton County health officials say those cases are coming from all zip codes through community spread, we wanted to check in with one population that has been hit hard already. Lily Sanchez is with La Paz, Chattanooga.
Lily, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
What are you and the folks at La Paz and Clinica Medicos seeing and hearing from the people that you're reaching out to and trying to help at this time?
As the numbers have begun to sort of increase in the Latinx Hispanic community, we've tried to identify as a group of community organizations that work with this community what the underlying sort of factor that has contributed to the uptick in cases. It's fortunate that more Latinos are coming out to get tested, but it's also unfortunate that this also means that the number in cases has grown. So it's kind of a win-lose situation. But we've seen that the underlying factor is really that these individuals and families haven't been able to adapt their lifestyle and their work life to accommodate the new normal that we have found ourselves in. And so these individuals are still going to work and still having to be in public amongst other people being exposed to the virus simply because the nature of their work isn't allowing really for self-isolation or social distancing.
What we're seeing in this community, in this area, we're seeing in other areas across the country.
Definitely. The factors that are contributing to the higher numbers here in Chattanooga is definitely not unique to Chattanooga. All over the country, you're seeing sort of pockets of Hispanic Latinx community members being affected disproportionately because these are the individuals who have essential jobs, individuals who don't qualify for government assistance such as unemployment or the stimulus financial support that we received. So these individuals have no other choice but to continue going to work in order to provide for their families. Also, these individuals often live in multi-family homes or multi-generational homes. And so they have a unique circumstances in that they don't really have the space physically, actually, to social distance themselves if they do end up testing positive.
There are the economic barriers, and then there are also the language and cultural barriers.
For sure. Because this is such new information to everybody across the entire globe, where you receive your information really matters, and the way in which you receive information matters. So these individuals are having to face an additional barrier where the information that is very timely, very sensitive, and very pertinent, they're struggling to receive this information simply because of the languages they speak. And so it's been kind of a second level of obstacles that our community members have been facing and the organizations that are trying to get this information to them.
What challenges are there at this time and going forward with access to testing, access to care?
Besides just the economic and language barrier, we've also seen individuals who sort of refrain from kind of acknowledging and engaging with the information regarding the virus simply out of fear of the unknown. It sort of does tie back into economic barriers. They're afraid that if they do kind of acknowledge and have to face the issue at hand, that it will become an economic burden to them, not only because of having to pause their working, but also having to treat this in case it becomes something unmanageable for them. And there are a lot of varying opinions across the community. It just depends on who you ask, how they have felt in this time regarding who to trust and who to look to for information and resources. Fortunately, we've been able to kind of be on the ground with organizations like Clinica Medicos and SEMPA, and with the established relationships and trust that we already have with this community, kind of infiltrate the information in a way that they're more susceptible to receiving and kind of accepting in a more comfortable manner.
What other challenges may be ahead as cases continue to spike and as more reopening takes place?
I think that across all cultures and across all economic statuses within the Chattanooga community, the main issue is going to be that individuals are seeking to kind of return to normalcy And the reopening of different businesses and public areas is kind of also encouraging that. So they might not take it as seriously. We've already seen individuals in our community kind of make up their minds about the virus and how it's going to affect their lives. But I would say that that's more to do with the fact that their lives never really were able to change because of the fact that they had to continue going to work. But I think that what La Paz and other community organizations are working on is continuing the education as the circumstances change, as businesses begin to open in public places, so that they understand that now that we're not fully in a phase of social distancing and self-isolation, there are still measures that need to be taken, and trying to communicate that to them in a way that doesn't instill fear in them, but instills a sense of responsibility as part of a larger community.
Where can people go online for more information, and where can they call?
For more information about the community efforts that La Paz is working on currently, they can go to lapazchattanooga.org or call 423-624-8414.
All right. Lily, thanks so much.
Thanks, Ray.
Teachers, both experienced and new, in this city and beyond, have been signing up for the Chattanooga AP Summer Institute. This year, the Institute's workshops are taking place online, and they will address broader challenges beyond the AP curriculum. John Fries is director of the Center for Professional Education on our campus, the University of Tennessee at Chattanooga. Alan Pratt is executive director of the National Rural Education Association, also located on the UTC campus.
John, Alan, thanks for joining us.
My pleasure to be here, Ray.
Yeah, thanks for the invite, Ray. Appreciate it.
John, tell us more about this program at UTC and what's going on this month.
Sure, Ray. So this will be our fourth year in offering our Chattanooga AP Summer Institute. An AP Summer Institute is simply a professional development program for advanced placement teachers in our area, and in this case, this year across the country. As you can well imagine, the prospect of delivering a program in a face-to-face environment this summer became, well, difficult to say the least. And we got permission to take that program and make it virtual. And as a result of doing that, we've been able to expand our reach even farther than we have in the past. As telling Alan, we've gone from 18 states, which was our record last year, to 36 this year. So we've doubled the number of states represented in this program. We've also, coincidentally, just about doubled the number of teachers participating. We've gone from 227, which was the high water mark last year, to 377 as of last time I looked.
Tell us more about what participants in the program are gaining out of this, what tools they are being equipped with to take them where to do what.
So in a normal year, the program would be focused on providing both new and experienced AP teachers with an opportunity to learn and better hone their skills to teach the AP curriculum in their classroom. This year, what we've realized is that we also have an opportunity, and I was telling Alan earlier, I think a responsibility to give many of these teachers who are participating an opportunity to learn and try out more in the distance learning environment. Really, our consultants are going to give them modeling on best practices of teaching and learning in an online environment. So we're going to focus on the curriculum, the AP curriculum. We're going to give our due to College Board, but we're also going to take that a step further and really hone those teaching and learning skills in an online environment.
That brings us, Alan, to your perspective in all this and needs in rural America.
John and I have spoke before and admire the work he's doing with training teachers for the AP courses. We've been a partner, a national partner with College Board since 2016. So our work has been kind of hand in hand with spreading the message for rural America, for SAT testing and the AP courses and the introduction of AP courses to a lot of the rural parts. So like John was talking about, with the pandemic and the switch from face-to-face learning to a virtual learning environment, and a real quick shift of 2 weeks in a lot of cases, we always knew there was inequities and there's issues from communities to communities, but the pandemic really highlighted the inequities in broadband and connectivity issues at home especially for students that can't afford the broadband or students that just simply don't have access because the service is not there. It really made a unique environment for our teachers to teach online and also be able to reach students either by calling them on a landline or delivering some type of packet for teaching. So it's been a real struggle from those areas.
Where do we see the needs going forward for this type of training and making that real, not only for those who might live in a city such as Chattanooga or larger and coming to UTC, albeit virtually, versus the students that are from rural areas and are having to deal with these issues on top of just participating in this program?
I think Ellen and I are both of the same philosophy. I don't think the need and or opportunity that's created by this is going to go away anytime soon. I think we were just talking the notion that this next school year won't have some level of disruption. Well, we can't guarantee that it will, and we can't guarantee that it won't. But if you're planning on it not having any disruption, you're really setting yourself up for a big, big disappointment, I think. So I think the need is going to persist. And quite honestly, I think, and that's the reason I bring the word opportunity into this, because as we know, a lot of times out of necessity, opportunities arise. And, you know, it will allow teachers and students to connect and learn and grow in different ways in the future that may have taken longer to get to those points in time just under the conventional ways, I guess, if you will. So I think this is creating an accelerated process for some schools.
And then how are you two coping with all of this work in setting this up? Because this wasn't the program that you had in mind.
I usually travel about 3 weeks out of every month going to different states. So about March 6th, my travel went from being gone at least 3 weeks a month to being at home for 4 weeks in a month and being in my office. I think it strengthened my marriage. On a side note, I guess in a good way, my kids are kind of like, God, you're here a lot. But anyway, that's a different story. But personally, I think the issues that we knew were there, that students are not properly fed throughout the summer or when they're not at school, they don't have the same access in rural areas and in urban areas too that other students do. And we see those inequities all the time. If we can solve some of those problems, I was listening to someone today on a podcast, and they were talking about what happened in Minnesota and the tragic death of a young man and what we're dealing with as a nation. And he said, protest is great. It's a way to voice your willingness to find some type of change. The key for us, and it's when I look at us in this whole situation, is we have to take this protest to policy shifts and mindset shifts in our country. And the same thing with the pandemic. We have to see what's not working and change policy or change behaviors to make it work. So I think that's kind of been an eye-opening experience for me. I think it's been a good experience for us to kind of pull together as our organization and for rural schools and communities and show that we can change rapidly and we can make adjustments.
Funny, made me think, I used to see Dr. Pratt a lot in Hunter Hall. My office used to be on that side of campus. And occasionally I'd say, in passing, how are things in rural America today? Knowing full well that he couldn't answer that question in the 5 seconds in which we would see each other. Probably if we'd sat down for the day, he wouldn't have been able to really tell me how are things in rural America. Ray, I think from our perspective, at least from planning this program for this summer, going back to something that Alan said earlier, you know, they had about 2 weeks to figure this out over the course of their spring breaks. To give you some, or at least from our perspective, what that perspective must have been like, we've had about 2 months to get ready to do this program virtually this summer. And it has taken, I would dare say, just about every minute of that 2 months to really fully pull it all together. We're still letting folks register. We are still going through all the processes to get them access to everything. But I will say this, it is even more impressive to me to think about in a matter of 2 weeks, completely building out and finishing out a school year in a completely different environment where we've had, obviously we've had the benefit of 2 months and it's taken every bit of that to get this ready.
And if people want more information online, where can they go?
We'd love for them to visit our website. It's www.utc.edu/APSI.
All right. John, Alan, thanks so much.
Thanks so much, Ray. Have a good afternoon.
Thank you.
When the coronavirus pandemic hit the Chattanooga area, Steam Logistics had just started a new policy allowing its employees to work from home. I spoke recently with Brittany Payone, the human resources manager at the international logistics firm.
Brittany, thanks for joining us.
Thank you. Glad to be here, Ray.
You folks at Steam Logistics already had developed your working from home arrangements before the coronavirus hit.
We were talking about it, and then we finally rolled out a policy for some of our staff to start working at home. With COVID-19 hitting, it really forced our hand to open that up company-wide. I have to say, with that whole transition, it was quite seamless for us. We're glad that the policy that we did create actually does work. When you're working from home, are people really working, or are they mowing their lawn? That was kind of one of our worries, but it's been completely proven untrue for us.
What is your policy, and how does that enable your business to do what it does?
Our operations team, which execute all of our international shipments, that they would start working in a flex schedule or a work from home type of situation. And it really would be dependent upon their tenure at Steam. So we wanted to have, with international shipping in general, there is a large learning curve. So we wanted to have an employee that had been there for at least a year, so they would have that experience and that knowledge before we kind of just set them free to work from home. However, we hired recently before COVID-19, and we ended up having a couple of our employees that had only been there for maybe a couple of weeks. And so we had to act quickly, and our whole team went home, even our sales. Like, we have such a big sales culture, and the way we run things, we like to have them in-house. So we have that camaraderie between the sales teams. There's music blaring, there's gongs going off every time they get a good sale or a good profit on a shipment. And so we were a little bit worried and hesitant about our sales. With them going home, are they going to have that same productivity? However, it's been proven and true. We've been able to ramp up our business more so than we thought we would be, and we're sitting pretty right now.
What are some things that you have learned that have worked very well, and some things that you're rethinking?
For us, communication was the key for all of us. We have less emails and more phone calls now. That has been good for us because we've been able to connect more on a personal level, I would say, with our coworkers, as opposed to just coworker to coworker now. One of the things that isn't really working for us is we miss each other. Working from home can be isolating, so it's imperative for us to ensure that our team is not forgotten during the separation from each other.
And also being mindful of colleagues who have families also staying at home, because some of you do and some of you don't.
Right. And some of us have children and we have to homeschool our children. Summer camps have been canceled, so that ongoing childcare is going to have to happen. So someone will have to stay home. And you have to be, like you said, mindful of that. So it's been a new territory for us to navigate through, but we've all adapted really well with it.
What are you hearing from your peers elsewhere in the industry?
Industry-wise, a lot of us, we all went to the online platform. Everyone's working virtually from home. And so we are now just trying to decide, how are we going to be bringing everybody back into the office? Like I said, that's a big question mark for us. We are waiting to get a little bit more guidance on how to do it. We have, of course, those reopening guidelines, but we want to ensure that we're doing our part to flatten the curve. We value transparency. We've always been very transparent about our commission structure, our financials, what's going on with the company and the health of the company. And it's no different with us working from home either. There's always autonomy, and we kind of glorify that. We want people to have ownership of what they do, and it's no different with people working from home.
One way or another, the culture at your workplace, whether it's all in person or it's a hybrid or it's all remote, it has changed, and it has changed for good.
It has. For us, culture is a living thing. though we are deliberate with our culture, we also know that the business is going to change and we need to change with it, but we need to steer it in the direction that we want it to be.
And where can people go online to follow Steam Logistics and everything you do?
Our website is www.steamlogistics.com. We are on Instagram at Steam Logistics and also on Facebook, which is Steam Logistics as well.
All right, Brittany, thanks so much.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you so much, Ray. I really appreciate it.
You're listening to Scenic Roots. More in a moment.
I'm Will Davis, and this is Tennessee Valley StoryCorps. Conversations from people who went to the StoryCorps recording booth when it came to Chattanooga's Miller Park in the spring of last year. Today, friends and fellow activists, Ginger Moss and Chuck Hamilton.
I know you through our local activism.
Yeah.
I'm a queer activist here in Chattanooga, and that's actually, I met you in our organizing to get an equality ordinance here, and I'm actually consider myself from the first generation that was truly out. There was a lot of backlash that came from it, but we were the first ones because we were post-Stonewall.
Stonewall, sixth birthday.
It seems like you're not only a historian, but you also have a background in activism. Can you tell me when you started your activism and in what areas?
I helped campaign. I wasn't part of the group at UTC, but I helped campaign to get the Gay-Straight Alliance approved as a campus organization.
What year was that? Do you remember?
81, 82.
Was there a lot of opposition to it?
I can't remember. Yeah, there was some in the Student Senate. And I stood up and I can't remember what I said, but after I spoke, nobody stood up to speak against it anymore, and it passed unanimously.
So would you consider that to be one of your first acts of activism?
Yeah, more or less.
I've always been out and loud. It sounds like you're from here. So, was your family here when you came out? Were your parents?
Oh, yeah. That's one thing. They don't care. They really don't care at all.
And never did?
No. Not when I started talking about it. I mean, you know, they're a little surprised at first, but then, I mean, they really don't care about that. They were more upset when I came out as atheist. That they were upset about. And people in my son's generation, when I was writing about it, was concerned with, you know, if I put this on my blog and put it on Facebook, how was it going to reflect on David? So I had him read it, and he got really moved about that. But I said, he said, "What do you want me to read this?" And I said, "Well, in case there's any backlash, Dad, people my age don't give a shit about this.
They really don't, and that's cool to me. That's the true hope." A lot of people do millennial bashing, and we've been really privileged to be around groups of millennials and Zs here in Chattanooga, particularly within our own LGBTQ community. And I find the people who do millennial bashing, I find what they do offensive because...
Yeah, me too.
Yeah.
Very much. I've defriended people on Facebook over it.
Yeah. If you had a message for the queer millennials and Zs about what you've been through in your life as a 55-year-old man here in Chattanooga, what would you want them to know?
If someone tells you you don't have a right to be who you are, tell them to go f*** themselves.
That was Chuck Hamilton and Ginger Moss. This Tennessee Valley StoryCorps conversation can be found at WUTC.org, and you can subscribe to the Tennessee Valley StoryCorps podcast wherever you get your podcasts. This series is produced and edited by me and brought to you, in part, by EPB Fiber Optics. I'm Will Davis.
This is Scenic Roots, live from Barking Legs. Good afternoon, everybody. I'm Richard Winham. While the theater is still closed, Barking Legs is continuing to showcase local musicians playing jazz in their virtual online lounge on their Facebook page every Wednesday evening, starting at 7. This past Wednesday, the featured group was David Schwab playing bass, Sean Perkinson playing the guitar, and on sax, Alan Wyatt.
Let's dig around midnight. Yeah, he'll have to dial that up. So, some people, of course, around midnight is a Thelonious Monk composition. And there's a very famous Miles Davis introduction that we're not going to do. So those of you Miles Davis fans out there that really need that, you'll just need to go to, you know, go find your recording of it, because this might not be so gratifying for you. So as soon as Sean remembers where R is in the alphabet, that was a joke. Okay. So no intro, we'll just...
Okay.
Yeah. Here we go, right on. 1, 2, 3, 4.
Thank you.
do Birds and the Bees. I first heard this piece, The Birds and the Bees, on an album with Pat Metheny and Jim Hall. Hello?
Yes.
Jim Hall. Yeah, duet. Hall album's a duet. And just love this piece and thought this would really be great for this group. So I hope you enjoy this. Sean is looking for this chart on a book that I gave him that is not in alphabetical order. Or numbers or anything like that. So it's a test of concentration. It's a test of concentration and mental prowess. Right. Crow's feet aren't either crows nor feet. Discuss.
Yeah. Thank you.
do some Disney.
Some
what? Yeah. Dave knows what I'm talking about.
Oh.
See that one. Yeah, that one.
Thank you.
This is a West Montgomery contrafact. That's the buzzword of the day. Contrafact is a new melody written over a standard chord progression. And West Montgomery called this 4-on-6, and it's written to the progression of Summertime, which absolutely it is in this room as well. So, in fact, I think it was said 95 degrees. I think that's what.
What?
Yeah, somewhere in my car. Maybe that was just inside my car, but anyway.
Turn the heat down.
So, yeah. So, hopefully you'll enjoy Wes Montgomery's version of Summertime, which he called 4-on-6.
Thank you.
Thank you, singular, plural.
Alan Wyatt playing sax, Sean Perkinson on guitar, and David Schwab playing bass in Barking Legs in their virtual lounge on their Facebook page. This is Scenic Roots, live from Barking Legs on listener-supported public radio, WUTC. I'm Richard Winham. We'll have another session live from their virtual lounge at Barking Legs next Tuesday on Scenic Roots.
I'm Ray Bassett. Thanks for listening to Scenic Roots. We come to you from WUTC at the University of Tennessee at Chattanooga. Thanks, as always, to our producers, Haley Solomon, Carly Dodson, Elena Nourabadi, Connor Brown, and Will Davis. Email us at scenicroots423@gmail.com. Follow us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at scenicroots423. Listen to us online anytime at WUTC.org and the WUTC app. For Richard Winham and the rest of our team, join us again next time for Scenic Roots.